Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. The UN Security Council held urgent talks Sunday about the deadly surge of violence in Aleppo as Syrian and Russian jet fighters bombarded the rebel-controlled eastern sector of the Syrian city. The United States, France, and Britain called the emergency session to pressure Russia to control its ally Syria to end the attacks on the 250,000 people trapped in the city. The assault, missile strikes, barrel bomb attacks, and artillery fire flattened buildings, leaving streets filled with debris and chunks of concrete. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said more than 150 airstrikes had hit the city in the last 3 days, accusing Russia and Syria of carrying out an all-out offensive to retake Aleppo.
It is time to say who is carrying out those airstrikes and who is killing civilians. Russia holds a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. This is a privilege and it is a responsibility. Yet in Syria and in Aleppo, Russia is abusing this historic privilege.
At least 115 people, mostly civilians, have been killed in the Aleppo bombardment since the Syrian army started its offensive late Wednesday. Videos released by police in Charlotte, North Carolina, Saturday show a deadly confrontation between police and Keith Lamont Scott, a 43-year-old black man who was shot to death Tuesday, triggering riots in North Carolina's largest city. The two videos from body cameras and dash cameras from officers confronting Scott were released Saturday after days of calls by protesters to make the footage public. A fifth day of protests was largely peaceful. This is VOA News. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will suspend weekend preparations for Monday's presidential debate when they meet separately Sunday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a key U.S. ally in the Middle East. The meeting with Trump, the Republican nominee, was arranged after Trump's campaign staff telephoned Netanyahu's office after finding out the Israeli leader was scheduled to meet with Clinton, his Democratic opponent. Iraqi officials say a suicide bomber has blown himself up in Baghdad, killing 7 people and wounding 19. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the blast Sunday in the Iskhan neighborhood, a mostly Shiite district. However, Islamic State, a Sunni group, considers Iraq's Shiite majority to be apostates and regularly targets them with bombings in crowded areas of Baghdad. Iraqi forces backed by coalition airstrikes have been fighting Islamic State militants since they captured large parts of Iraq more than 2 years ago. The leader of a jihadist group of Boko Haram reappeared in a video posted on social media Sunday, saying he's in good health and rejecting statements by the Nigerian army he has been seriously wounded. Speaking in Hausa, Arabic, and English, and in dialects spoken in northeast Nigeria, a man purporting to be Abubakar Shekau spoke in a 40-minute video addressed to the military. The video was released on YouTube and dated September 25th. Last month, Nigeria's Air Force said Shekau had been wounded in an operation that killed senior members of Boko Haram. A gunman has killed a prominent Jordanian writer in front of the courthouse where the writer was facing charges that a cartoon posted on his Facebook page was offensive to Islam. Nahed Hattar was shot and killed Sunday in front of Amman's Palace of Justice. The state news agency Petra reported the shooter was arrested. Saeed Hattar is a cousin of the writer.
Well, I feel that this is his death is a huge loss to the nation, to the country, to the voice of Jordan, because he's a public figure, and his loss is a huge loss to the country and to the pan-Arab cause.
The victim, who was a Christian, said the cartoon was intended as a mockery of jihadists. The cartoon showed an Arab man with two women asking God to bring him a drink. A 20-year-old suspect has been arrested in connection with a shooting spree at a mall in the U.S. northwestern state of Washington. Arjan Jetton of Oak Harbor, Washington, was apprehended Saturday nearly 24 hours after the massive manhunt for him had begun. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
What this museum does show us is that even in the face of oppression, even in the face of unimaginable difficulty, America has moved forward.
U.S. President Barack Obama dedicates the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture.
He says, if they remain adamant, it is not all permanent members being tough.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe warns the United Nations the African Union plans to form a splinter group.
They are ready to fight for their rights, for their sovereignty. And we are, once they take that route, certainly we have got to go back to the people and mobilize them to reject these maneuvers.
And the Lord Mayor of Kampala threatens legal action over a newspaper publication. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. President Barack Obama led the nation in dedicating the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Tens of thousands of people gathered on the National Mall in Washington as the new $540 million museum opened its doors to the public. VOA's Chris Simpkins has more on the museum and those who made the journey to be among the first to see it.
Let us now open this museum to the world.
It's America's newest museum, and it's fitting that the country's first black president dedicated it.
But what this museum does show us is that even in the face of oppression, even in the face of unimaginable difficulty, America has moved forward. And so this museum provides context for the debates of our times.
Ringing a bell that hung in a church built by slaves and free blacks, Obama officially opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. It was a celebration for thousands who journeyed to the nation's capital to be among the first to see the museum.
The depiction that they used, from the chronological approach that they used, was exceptional.
The museum takes visitors on a journey through time, from the dark chapters of slavery through racial segregation and discrimination.
And a lot of people don't want to talk about slavery, but I think it's very important because, our ancestors came from Africa. They were brought over here. They were slaves. And I don't think that it's something to be ashamed of. I think that they're very strong, that they made it this far.
Many items in the museum are priceless heirlooms from family collections. The collections tell the stories not just of famous people, but also those of ordinary people determined to make their lives better, such as Alex Davis from Michigan, who participated in the civil rights demonstrations.
I think the kids today need to know that there was a history that needed to be changed, and somebody had to do that. So it's like I tell my kids, I march so that you don't have to.
People here say the museum will serve as a lasting showcase of the challenges African Americans have faced and how much they have contributed to the country's history. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe says the African Union is planning to form a splinter group with countries such as Russia, China, and India if the United Nations Security Council does not include members of his continent next year. For VOA, Sebastian Nhofu has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
President Robert Mugabe says the African Union is still concerned that it had no permanent seats on the UN Security Council. On arrival in Harare from New York for this year's United Nations General Assembly late Saturday, the 92-year-old Zimbabwean leader told ZANU-PF supporters the African Union wanted to be on the UN Security Council if no veto powers of the five permanent members, China, France, the United Kingdom, the US, and Russia, are not removed. He says if they remain adamant, it is not all permanent members being tough. It is not all permanent members being tough, he says. It is Britain, France, and the United States of America. If they remain adamant, he adds, they must not cry foul when we agree to form our own organization with countries like China, India, and other Asian countries, he said. This is what we want to do next year in September, when we have made a commitment. During his 30-minute speech, Mugabe did not make reference to calls made Thursday by his Botswana counterpart, Ian Khama, to step down and allow fresh blood to improve Zimbabwe's economy. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The Gabonese Constitutional Court confirmed that incumbent President Ali Bongo won the presidential poll held last month, extending his family's four-decade rule over the Central African nation. Bongo's main rival Jean Ping said on Saturday that it was a denial of democracy and asked for the international community to take notice. But President Bongo called for a political dialogue and asked all candidates to work with him. For VOA, Emily Ube has more from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan.
Shortly after midnight, Gabon's highest court announced results slightly modified from those announced by the Electoral Commission a few days after the vote, but came to the same conclusion that Ali Bongo won the August 27th presidential poll with just over 50% of the ballots. Bongo's margin of victory is 11,700 votes more than his main rival, Jean Ping. The court rejected Ping's appeal to recount the vote. The former minister turned opposition leader has claimed some of the results, especially those in Bongo's stronghold province, which showed a 99% turnout, were not credible. Shortly after the decision by the Constitutional Court, Ali Bongo called for a national dialogue.
Le score de cette victoire signifie qu'il y a de nombreux électeurs.
Bongo says the numbers show that there are many voters who did not choose his project and that he must understand them. I therefore called all political leaders, including the unfortunate candidates of the August 27th presidential poll, to work with me, said 41-year-old Bongo. He is the son of Omar Bongo and became president in 2009 after a controversial election following the death of his father, who ruled the Central African country for 42 years. His rival, Jean Ping, is a former ally of Bongo's father and several-time minister who fell out with the current president a couple of years ago. Shortly after the court ruling, his spokesperson maintained to a French news agency that Ping had won the elections. The first announcement of the election result last month triggered a wave of deadly violence across the country that left at least five people dead. Some have feared that more unrest could follow the court's decision, and security has been increased in the capital city, Libreville. VOA's French of Africa's correspondent in Libreville said the streets were quiet on Saturday. The government said it would hold Ping responsible if clashes were to happen. Emilia for VOA News in Abidjan.
Gambians are bracing for the upcoming presidential election slated for the 1st of December with great interest. The opposition recently met to discuss about forming an alliance in a bid to oust incumbent President Yahya Jammeh. However, one candidate getting the attention of Gambians is the first woman independent candidate, Dr. Aissatou Touré. For VOA reporter Alpha Jalou caught up with her in the Gambian capital, Banjul, and asked her what her motivations are.
First and foremost, I'm a citizen. Number two, I have been an active onlooker, looking at the political process for the last 22 years. Of course, with in sympathy with the opposition parties who have been trying to restore democracy and trying to make efforts to bring in changes that will usher in a new democracy in the Gambia. But apparently, I have been watching and I've seen that for the past 22 years, they have been unable to effect this change as we all desire. And I felt that In 2006, NAD was a great opportunity, but that did not succeed. In 2011 also, we have the United Front, and it was not possible. So I decided to go into what we call reflections as to why are we failing and why are we having all these problems. I realized that we need to change our strategies.
Now, Doctor, you are the first Gambian woman vying for the presidency. If elected, what are your priorities?
My priorities are to set the institutions right. And when I say the institution, there are different levels. One, we want to bring in constitutional reform, electoral reform, strengthening the institution, restoring freedom of expression, and strengthening all the department, all the institutions that are going to set the pace for a proper democracy to function. And then we will try to bring in the right competence within institutions for them to respond into it. And part of which is building the institution and making them strong, and also thinking about the human rights situation. There has been a lot of abuses. There is trauma, pain, and people are really disgusted. And you can understand capturing that negative energy that people are living with. We have to put a strategy in place to contain that. Rightly so, they have felt the pain, but we have to be able to do the right thing and not to repeat the same mistakes. That is the reason why I am thinking of certain committees and commissions to put in place to work closely with those commissions with the right technical expertise to capture that energy and transform it into a positive one.
And how do you plan to improve the economy?
You have commissions that are going to be there. The economy will be given a great opportunity to redefine itself. We will liberalize trade. We will also create an opportunity where we have different forms of the private sector and the public sector. By avoiding wasteful spending, we will create more jobs that would motivate the young generation of school leavers and job seekers to remain in the country. We will motivate and encourage Gambian scholars and academics abroad to return and contribute their quota. And the development of the private sector is a key issue in creating jobs, because nowhere in the world you will find governments creating all the jobs. So Gambia is a very small country, and we have people who are willing to come invest both within and outside to be able to do. And this is what this current regime has destroyed. You want them to give you percentages. You want them to give you certain concessions that is going to come to your pocket. It is not going to work. So I want to make a robust approach to it to ensure that jobs are created in order to curb the migration and the hopelessness that these youths are feeling in their hearts and minds, and make the Gambia a better place.
We also know that, Dr. Touré, the Gambia is being criticized for its lack of democracy and rule of law. How do you plan to create democracy or strong democratic institutions if elected?
In fact, that's one of my primary responsibilities, together with my cabinet and the people, to strengthen the institutions, to do the reforms that have actually, the amendments that have been made to destroy democracy will be revisited by the experts. We will also strengthen, invite both national, international expertise to be able to look at what does it require to restore democracy. We know that the electoral process have completely been abused. We have to bring in the two-term limit. We also have to allow for the diasporan Gambians, wherever they are, to be able to come back or go there and vote and be voted. We would also like to strengthen the judiciary, that to take up their positions with respect and dignity, and restore the dignity and freedom. We want to create institutions that will bring in freedom of expression and restore the dignity of the people, and many other aspects that democracy requires in terms of bringing in sanity to the whole fabric of Gambian society.
And how much government policy should you spend on education and health if you are elected in December 2016?
I have a lot for all the sectors, because what I intend to do is to work with the experts. If you go to the website where I have my manifesto, I have given some information on how I intend to address education, how I intend to address health, the economy, the youth, and so on and so forth. So these plans are there, and I am telling you, I intend to give focus to those institutions, because these are the institutions that need to get the dignity and attract the right type of funding. The Gambia alone cannot do it. We need to work together. We need to be part of the larger community, and we need to influence certain things.
Dr. Aissa Touré is a Gambian independent presidential candidate. She spoke with reporter Alpha Jallo from Banjul. The Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital Kampala says the Kampala Capital City Authority, or KCCA, has failed to pay him 30 months of salaries due him after he was controversially impeached. Erias Lukwago says he is owed $165,497, which he says the KCCA owes him from December 2013 to May 2016. This despite a court ruling rejecting the impeachment. For more, I reach the Lord Mayor, Erias Lukwago.
It's a matter of great concern to me, and of course it's an injustice being meted out against me. It's a legal entitlement. There was an attempt to impeach me, which I vehemently fought, and successfully I litigated over that matter. I got a judgment in my favor where court made a finding that indeed the impeachment was null and void, and that I should be reinstated, and all my emoluments and the benefits that accrued at that time should be cleared. And that was way back in March 2014. Since then, I've made incessant demands, and matters even went to Parliament. They even put in place committees to handle those matters. Actually, there was an attempt at a dialogue, which was presided over by one, the former Prime Minister, Honorable Mama Mbabazi, which came to naught. And then, of course, subsequently, his successor came in, the current Prime Minister, right, Honorable Ruhakana Rugunda.
Some of your opponents and critics are saying that since you were successfully impeached, for all those months, you were not working, so you should not be paid. What do you say to that?
Well, that would be very, very unfortunate if there were people who made such arguments. Because indeed, if they believe in the due process of the law, if they believe in the rule of law, they shouldn't be saying that. I went to court and won. The judgment of the High Court, which was delivered on, to be precise, on the 28th of March 2014, everything was quashed. The purported impeachment was declared invalid, and even the attempt to never materialized because the Attorney General had indicated they were going to appeal. Up to now, they never appealed against that decision. And for heaven's sake, I kept on doing my work despite the fact that the office was locked, because my work is not only sitting in office and doing the desk work and, of course, presiding over functions, as it were, but it entails so many other things, including giving political guidance, including oversight and putting to task those who are supposed to account for public funds to do so and so on. I kept on doing that work. In any case, it's a legal entitlement. So now we have been summoned before Parliament. Actually, Parliament was supposed to sit last week. Unfortunately, it didn't take off, and now the proceedings were adjourned to Tuesday next week. Hopefully, when we appear before Parliament, this matter will be resolved, I hope.
There were local reports in the Ugandan media that General Salim Saleh, who is the brother of President Yoweri Museveni, is putting up a building for you that runs into billions of shillings.
Total crap. That is ridiculous. You know, those tabloids have got practice of maligning some of us. They have been running fabricated stories against me. Of course, they are being engineered by this government to create public mistrust and, of course, to bring my good name into disrepute. It's absolutely false. It is trash. And I've indicated that, indeed, if they don't retract it, I'm going to court. And if they don't pay me damages of 3 billion Uganda shillings, certainly I'm going to file a case. If they have not retracted those fallacious and defamatory statements, I'm filing a case in court on Monday morning.
A motion has been tabled, or a bill has been tabled in Parliament, to make the position of the Lord Mayor of Kampala City to be basically ceremonial. So the minister will hold all the powers. What is your reaction to this motion?
Well, there have been those machinations and maneuvers being engineered by this government for some time. You know, President Museveni lost legitimacy, lost support in Kampala. In fact, his stay in power right now is illegitimate. And that is the crisis he's facing. The people of Kampala have rejected him since 1996. They have not voted for him. So he wanted to indulge in political machinations and manipulations so that he can take over governance in Kampala. And they have tried to tinker and manipulate the laws for so many decades. They have failed. So they are at it again because they are trying now to resuscitate a bill which had lapsed with the expiry of the 9th Parliament. Yes, they tabled a bill in the 9th Parliament wherein they sought to amend the KCC Act and vested the powers of, governance matters in the office of the minister who is directly appointed by the president. We resolutely, fought that with the support of the people, and eventually we succeeded, and that's how I got elected back into the office. So now they are trying to hatch a new plot to overturn the sovereignty of the people in Kampala, and that's why they are now tinkering with the law. I'm told they are resuscitating this bill so that they can make the minister for Kampala, the political head of Kampala, and also whittle down further the role of the Lord Mayor in Kampala, the Lord Mayor who is popularly elected by the people, and this is their game plan. But I'm glad the people of Kampala are not sleeping. They are ready to fight for their rights, for their sovereignty. And once they take that route, certainly we have got to go back to the people and mobilize them to reject these maneuvers.
Erias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital. He spoke with me from Kampala. Meanwhile, the 5th annual Gay Pride Parade in Uganda was scheduled to take place Saturday. However, police intervention quickly broke up the celebration before the march got underway. After a second failed attempt at holding a pride parade this year, many feel the move signals a crackdown on LGBT spaces. For the UA, Elizabeth Pollard reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Down a nondescript dirt road on the shores of Lake Victoria, Uganda's LGBT community assembled for their 5th annual pride parade. It was the second venue of the day after police turned revelers away from the Entebbe Botanical Gardens, where the parade has traditionally been held. For one of the parade's dignitaries, named Ms. Pride, the tension made it difficult to celebrate.
We're under pressure, security, what. But at the moment, because we could not do anything, I was expected to be the Miss Pride of this year, but I could not even have my crown on my head. The reason being, because of insecurities, and I cannot do anything because of all that.
However, just as people had begun to relax, two trucks carrying police arrived at the venue. Without any explanation, they ordered everyone back onto the buses. As the buses pulled away, many voiced their anger.
Have these rights at all. We are all Ugandans, and we have these rights to celebrate this pride.
Organizer and activist Kasha Jacqueline Nabagasera refused to leave the venue.
And now the police officer is telling us to leave. So I want clarity on what grounds should we leave. We are just people who have come to have fun. Until he gives us reasons and any legal offenses that we've committed, we are not going anywhere because this is a public park. We are Ugandans and we're here to celebrate pride.
The police eventually towed Nabagasera's car and escorted the buses down the main highway towards Kampala. Many worried they were headed to the police station. One man, in a panic, jumped out of the window of the moving bus. When the convoy stopped, tensions boiled over. Although police made their presence known, they did not interact with those protesting. Soon after, pressure from nearby fruit vendors caused the convoy to start up again and continue a few miles down the road, where police abandoned their escort. Police have not been available for comment. Tensions over LGBT activities have been high since August, when police raided an LGBT event during Pride Week. The Minister of Ethics and Integrity, Simon Lokoto, repeatedly warned the LGBT community to cancel all Pride events. Homosexuality is illegal in Uganda and can carry a penalty of up to 7 years in prison. However, Pride organizers say they will continue fighting for their rights despite intimidation. Lisbeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. Zamalek of Egypt suffered a shock 5-2 defeat at Wydad Casablanca of Morocco on Saturday, but still qualified to meet Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa in the 2016 Africa Champions League final. Zamalek won the first leg of the semi-final 4-0 in Alexandria last weekend and squeezed through 6-5 on aggregate. Zamalek, who last won the competition 14 years ago, will now meet Mamelodi Sundowns in the two-leg final next month. Sundowns will host the first leg on Friday, October 14th, with Zamalek holding the second leg a week later. Mamelodi Sundowns booked their place earlier on Saturday with a 2-0 home win over Zambia's Zesco United to progress a 3-2 on aggregate. Sundowns and Zamalek also met in the group stage of the African Champions League this year, with the South African club winning twice. The Champions League winners will represent Africa at the FIFA Club World Cup in Japan in December. Meanwhile, in athletics, Ethiopia's Kenenisa Bekele beat Kenya's Wilson Kipsang to win the BMW Berlin Marathon on Sunday. His winning time of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 3 seconds was an Ethiopian record and the second fastest time in history on a record-eligible course. Bekele took command of the race inside the final kilometer, surging away from former world record holder Kipsang to take his first victory in Berlin, smashing Haile Gebrselassie's Ethiopian record of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 59 seconds in the process. Our energetic Andy Edwards was in Berlin and caught up with Wilson Kipsang immediately after the race. Andy?
We're talking with the man who ran a personal best at the BMW Berlin Marathon today, Wilson Kipsang. He broke the world record here 3 years ago. Didn't quite do that, and he didn't quite win. He was second behind Kenenisa Bekele. Still a fantastic race. Do you have mixed feelings, Wilson? Because you ran your best time ever, but you were second.
For sure, I think today's race was really one of the best races. And at the moment, I have mixed feelings because, first of all, is that I'm very happy that I've really run my personal best. And it's a comeback race for me. For the last three or four races, I've not really done very well. And for this one, I think it's really a comeback race, and I've run very well, running a 2:13. That's really good. And the other feeling is that my plan was really to break the record, but it didn't go very well. But I missed it by very few seconds. And my compatriot, Kenenisa Bekele, winning, I think that's... I really don't feel very well.
It was so exciting to see the lead change hands. You know, we don't always have that in marathons. What did it feel like to up against another great runner, not only yourself, but Kenenisa?
Yeah, I think it was really fantastic for me to battle with Kenenisa Bekele. He was closing the gap, trying to leave me, and then I was closing the gap. So that kind of exchange was really good. But you find that it really assisted us so much to push and run for good time.
You certainly had a good time. We had a good time watching. Wilson Kipsang of Kenya, second in the BMW Berlin Marathon 2016. Personal best as well. Congratulations all the same. Thank you, Wilson.
Thank you too.
Andy Edwards in Berlin. Kipsang came home second in 2 hours, 3 minutes and 13 seconds, taking 10 seconds off his personal best. The women's race saw Ethiopia's Aberu Kabede take victory in commanding fashion, running 2 hours, 20 minutes and 45 seconds to come home more than 3 minutes clear of compatriot Behane Dibaba. Kabede, Dibaba and fellow Ethiopian Ruti Aga ran together through 15 kilometers in 49 minutes and 40 seconds, but Kabede began to press on along before halfway, which she reached in 1 hour 9 minutes. From there, she extended her advantage all the way to the finish, coming up just 15 seconds shy of her personal best of 2 hours, 20 minutes and 30 seconds. Over 41,000 runners from 122 countries entered the 43rd edition of the race, which is part of the Abbott World Marathon Majors. Finally, in rugby, Uganda Cranes on Saturday scored 6 tries to beat Namibia 38-19 and lift their maiden African Rugby Cup Sevens title at Safaricom Stadium, Karasani. Defending champions Kenya finished third after they crushed Madagascar 46-0 in the playoffs. Uganda beat Kenya 17-12 in the semi-finals. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
You
enjoy.
You are my master. I'm not alone. Anywhere you lead me, I will go. You are my master. I'm not alone. Anywhere you lead me, I will go. And I'll go. I will follow you. I'll go. All of the days of my life, Lord, I'll go.
Go. TME say, everything cool with you and we say,
yeah.
I did walk and they talk, but I won't stop, cause I got too much money left for me. Now Baba God said so, Mama Ramoto, Baba Tiffy, me simple, my chaye ori mi, Eshu ole mu mi, my shori re, Chero o elo, let's go, cause if I die today, nobody gon' die with me. Hear my phone ring. I don't send nobody. I'ma keep doing my thing. And if you're feeling me now, then let me hear you sing.
Girl.
My child will be me. My child will be me. My child will be me.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightland Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. At the 71st session of the General Assembly, the troubling issue of some African leaders clinging on to power no matter what resonated prominently. The outgoing Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, in his final address before the General Assembly in the general debate, pointedly noted that there are leaders who are trying to change their constitution or manipulating the political system to cling on to power. The president of Ghana, in his own statement before the General Assembly, underlined that the credential of Ghana to a major democratic state is related to its acceptance of the two-term limit. Yet, we see across Africa many attempts still being made to prolong the term of office of heads of state. We are seeing the serious consequences which has resulted in the loss of many lives of refugees, for example, in Burundi. And now we are seeing the same games being played in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC. A few months back, we saw the first act in this game. The Constitutional Court of the DRC announced that should elections not take place this year, it would be legally possible for President Joseph Kabila to continue in office. A few months later, the Electoral Commission of the DRC announced that it could not arrange for election this year and that elections should be postponed. The African Union appointed a mediator, Kocho, to see what could be done. The opposition did not want to have any discussions, particularly under Kocho, because they believe that he's too cozy with Kabila. Now we have a situation where part of the opposition is discussing with the government under Kocho for what should happen post-2016. All of these are going on with more and more bloodshed. The security forces have been attacking the opposition headquarters, and we can guess or expect more bloodshed in the DRC. One may ask, who is this man that is about to unleash real disaster in the DRC? Joseph Kabila was trained in China as a military officer. He came into the DRC to fight along his father, Laurent Kabila, who was a rebel leader. Because of the repugnance of the authoritarian rule of Mobutu, some African countries helped Laurent Kabila to oust Mobutu in 1997. In 2001, under mysterious circumstances, Laurent Kabila was assassinated and his son, Joseph Kabila, walked into the office. In 2006, Kabila was elected democratically. And in 2011, under much controversy, he was re-elected. So this is the man who has been in power since 2001. Still wanting to continue in office, no matter whether many Congolese would die. I'm aware that many Africans are divided on the issue of time limit, but we have to see what are the consequences when leaders try to cling on to power. The rest of the international community is also not consistent. The Western powers are often quick to criticize someone like Zimbabwean leaders for being too long in office. But they are very silent when a leader in Cameroon stays on and on and on in power. But African leaders should understand that unless they have a grip on this issue, we are going to see more and more bloodshed. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders always say, some birds avoid water, ducks seek it. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
7 years ago, at the G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy, President Barack Obama pledged the United States to a $3.5 billion investment in agriculture-led economic growth to combat hunger. This commitment helped garner more than $16 billion from other donors to support this new approach to advance agricultural development and reduce hunger around the world. President Obama's pledge gave rise to the Feed the Future initiative, a global program to fight hunger and poverty. In a recently issued report entitled A Food Secure 2030, Feed the Future notes that L'Aquila marked a turning point in the fight against global hunger and poverty because it was able to garner the political will and resources necessary for such a transnational food security and anti-poverty program to succeed. And succeed it did. Working with both government and private partners all over the world, Feed the Future has helped countries raise their agricultural output and improve nutrition for those in need. So, for example, last year alone, 9 million farmers and producers who worked with Feed the Future markedly improved their yields and efficiency, collectively boosting their incomes by more than $800 million. In the report, Feed the Future calls for governments of developing countries to lead the fight against hunger and poverty by mobilizing the resources, partnerships, and policies that are required for success, for donors to renew and increase their monetary commitments, for the private sector to raise their engagement and investment levels, and for civil society to pressure and support these actors to translate commitments into action. If this can be achieved, the world will be a different place by the year 2030. It will be a world free from hunger, malnutrition, and poverty, where thriving local economies generate increased income for all people, where people consume balanced and nutritious diets, and children grow up healthy and reach their full potential, and where resilience helps to reduce vulnerability. For the first time ever, humanity is within reach of the elimination of hunger, undernutrition, and extreme poverty. To achieve this milestone, the United States calls on the global community to unite around our shared vision by the year 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.